This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, the show where we go behind the headlines and explore issues driving the press. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. It's the first Monday of 2021, and joining me on the inaugural show of the year is Tashni Sukumaran, Malaysian correspondent with the South China Morning Post. Tashni, Happy New Year and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
You've been reporting on Malaysia for the South China Morning Post for around 3 years now. And your stories cover a wide range of issues, from the hard politics to the human interest pieces. How do you decide what to write about? What's your brief from SCMP as the Malaysian correspondent?
Well, the thing about being a correspondent for any news outlet, sort of regional, international, is that you're expected to take ownership of the portfolio and, you know, look at what's happening, the trends, the breaking news, what people are interested in, and sort of be on the ball and base your stories off of that. And of course, you have instructions from your editors who are watching closely, and they will alert you if there are things that they feel an international readership may be interested in that you may not be so aware of because, you know, sometimes you get very closed in by the country.
Mm-hmm. Does it influence how you write the story, whether it's a Malaysian audience or foreign audience?
Definitely. So if it's a international regional audience, you have to contextualize a lot more. You have to make it accessible, and you have to tell them why they should care or why it's interesting. Whereas for a Malaysian audience, you can do sort of daily updates. And because we've been following the news from day one, we're like, oh, okay, this is something that I want to be updated about, or this is something that I know the context for, I know what's been going on. So I can just read it and not have to read the last four or five paragraphs of background. And I think that's especially the case with Malaysia because our politics have so much context going back years. And I think a lot of reporters will agree with me when I say that when you want to contextualize the stories, so example, talking about Mahathir and Anwar's relationship, how do we mention, like, he used to be prime minister, he used to be deputy prime minister, they were close, they fell out, then they sort of became friends again for the elections, and then they fell out, and that's a lot of context that you have to, you know, make accessible to readers.
What's your sense of what kinds of stories foreigners are interested to read about when it comes to Malaysia?
Obviously, our politics are very interesting. I think there's a lot of appetite for our legal reform and human rights stories, interestingly enough. I think, of course, the role we play in ASEAN, South China Sea, Indo-Pacific sort of things, trade deals. I think there's a lot of interest in that. There's obviously an appetite for maybe the quirkier stories, but that's, I think, in any country.
In terms of the quirky stories, what do you think was something, what were some of the stories that stood out for you this year?
This year? So this is obviously not quirky, haha, but it's sort of quirky in that anyone reading it will be like, oh, I feel so sorry for these people when we talk about all these water cuts. So we have a year of pandemics, right, of a pandemic, and everyone's saying, wash your hands. And then we're just plagued by water cuts every few months, if not weeks. It's verging on ridiculous, really. So that is something people would read. I did a listicle once, which actually went down quite well, on all our really sort of tearjerker Hari Raya ads. I really enjoyed that. It was so sad. I cried, you know, so I think that came out. So that would be like a quirkier story that people would enjoy reading.
Okay, so quirky is a mix of both the serious and lighthearted. Now, taking an overall look at the pandemic year that was 2020, what were the top stories for you? I guess, what stories in 2020 would you recommend that would explain to a foreigner what Malaysia is going through?
Okay, I actually pulled up a list that I worked on for this. So Langkah Sheraton, i.e. the fall of Pakatan Harapan and the rise of Perikatan Nasional, very important. The MCO, and of course, subsequently, all its iterations, as well as the attempt at an emergency, very important. Of course, the conviction of former Prime Minister Najib Razak in court. I think the by-election in Sabah, sorry, not by-election, the state election in Sabah is very key because it was sort of a turning point for numbers, of the COVID numbers. I think that's important. And I think Anwar's strong, formidable, and convincing statement, which was in September? Yeah, September. I think that was actually quite an important news point, which I would have to explain to people and then, of course, contextualize.
Now, the pandemic has been hard on everybody, but how has it impacted your work, specifically as a journalist?
Okay. I think I speak for actually a lot of reporters who have to go on the field as well in Malaysia. The pandemic has made it a lot more difficult to access information in certain ways. Obviously, not all press conferences are open to the media. The ones that are sometimes only for official media, or they have a cap. We have to take pains to be safe ourselves when we go to these functions. And, you know, mask up, keep distance, which is sometimes really, really impossible. Let's be fair. So there's that. One sort of, for me, bright spot is that interviewees, like, are sometimes, not obviously politicians and things like that, but sort of your normal everyday interviewee, they're much more open now to using Zoom, email, phone call, when previously there was always this sense like, I want to meet you, I want to get to know you face-to-face, which is completely normal mm-hmm. and acceptable. But I think because of the pandemic, people are a lot more open to this idea of connecting digitally, which I think is quite forward-thinking and allows us to access people in maybe different states that we wouldn't be able to access as easily before this.
Okay. So that's, I guess, the silver lining in this whole thing, the digital revolution of sorts.
Yeah, a slim silver lining.
Okay. So here's a bit of a random question. What word would you use to describe 2020 off the top of your head?
I want to say resilient, in that I saw a lot of resilience from the people I reached out to, the people I interviewed. But at the same time, I'm really aware that saying that comes from a position of incredible privilege, because the truth of the matter is that people shouldn't have to be resilient, right? People shouldn't have to struggle in this kind of situation to make ends meet. I know a lot of people sort of from middle class, upper middle class backgrounds were actually quite happy about the MCO in some ways, because besides not being able to see your friends, you got to bake and catch up on your reading and catch up on your Netflix. And during this time, I was following, you know, sort of the migrant community, the refugee community, the B40 community, although I don't like that term, B40 community, very closely. And it was honestly heartbreaking. A friend of mine was telling me that some people went to withdraw ASB and they were just there to get like 50 ringgit so they can pay off, you know, the motorbike or buy new shoes for their kids. And you saw such resilience and such toughness in these stories, but we shouldn't have to be, right? A society is measured by the most disenfranchised and how they can cope with this sort of difficult circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the pandemic showed that we actually don't have a very good safety net for those who need it?
Our safety net is terrible. It really threw into relief the inequality, not even the urban-rural divide, but within Kuala Lumpur itself. And I mean, you can look at a recent sort of report, I think, released sort of by DM Analytics, which talks about this and how female-led households are the most vulnerable, and, you know, protein consumption dropped during the MCO because couldn't afford it, and instant noodle consumption skyrocketed. And I think the savings that most households had averaged out to like 300 ringgit for female-led households, and I think 75 ringgit for people whose homes included a person with a disability. I'm, you know, pulling these figures out, so I may be slightly off, but I think it's roughly around there. So yeah, I mean, we can look at how this inequality has not just been thrown into relief, but actually become more pronounced because of the pandemic and the measures put in place to control the spread of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking to Tashni Sukumaran, Malaysian correspondent with the South China Morning Post. When we come back after these messages, moving past 2020 with Project 5050. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. I'm Shazana, and with me today is Tashni Sukumaran, Malaysian correspondent with the South China Morning Post. Before the break, we were talking about the impact of the pandemic on the vulnerable groups in our society, including migrant workers and their experiences, which you wrote about in the middle of this year. Your Labor Day coverage on migrant workers caught the attention of the authorities, and you were actually called in for questioning by the police. Could you tell us from your point of view what happened and what the issue was about?
I wrote a report on May Day about the raids and the treatment of migrant workers, documented, undocumented. And I was then called in for questioning regarding the story. And I think the allegation was something like I had offended public order or unrest, something like that. They asked a lot of questions on, you know, what did I deem a human rights violation? And why did I make this about immigration and the police and not KKM, for example? And to me, I think it was harassment, plain and simple. Mm-hmm. The fact that nothing came of it, I really think that this, coupled with the way they treated, for example, Al Jazeera, shows that they were perhaps sensitive about certain of their policies and looking to clamp down on mm-hmm. on criticism.
And I think your case gained a lot of attention all over the world, and it really drew attention to the issue of press freedom in Malaysia. I was wondering whether, I mean, what do you think? Do you think that these kind of press freedom issues tend to overshadow the original story that you were trying to bring to light?
So I think that's a really good question, because it's a key tenet of journalism that you don't become a story. And I was honestly, for one, I was quite dismayed, because I wanted the issue to be about migrant workers. And I suppose the compensation for that is for us to, for journalists to focus on the issue and draw back that focus. However, when it's a clampdown on civil liberties, that is as important, I think, especially, for example, if you look at Amnesty International's latest campaign, they talk about this worrying trend of a clampdown on civil liberties. So that does, you know, sort of require some attention in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem now is that there are just too many things to look at. But that's been the nature of the year, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think this story drew such a defensive reaction from the authorities?
I think because for one, SCMP was one of the first to report on these raids. And I think in a way that drew in a lot of different voices. So I spoke to someone who was in the red zone. I spoke to sort of regional and local sort of watchdogs. And it managed to draw these threads together and contextualize, again, context, Malaysia's extremely poor treatment of migrant workers, documented and undocumented, for the last few decades. So yes, it did attract ire, but why that level of ire, I'm not so sure.
And the issue of migrant workers has become a touchy subject for Malaysians in general. I mean, we saw a rise in the airing of xenophobic views on social media, and this is something that you wrote about in your articles. What do you think happened to Malaysian compassion?
I think in times of economic hardship, in times of great stress, it's quite common for a populace to become very restive. This is compounded by the stresses of sort of switches in government, switches in policy, the uncertainty. So you will see this give rise to xenophobia. At the same time, this was made worse by, I think, certain actors who went out to feel the flames purposefully, right? Like, and that's why hate speech really needs to be looked into here and not, you know, reporting. So I don't think there's a dearth of compassion per se. We can look at, like, from movements like Kita Jaga Kita and all of these that Malaysians did band together. But I also do think it was very much a symptom, the flip side of xenophobia and hate was very much a symptom of a restive populace, sort of discontent with their lot in general, and looking for someone to take it out on, which doesn't make it okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you've been covering the living conditions of migrant workers since early on in the pandemic. I mean, back in April, you wrote articles about the cramped living conditions of construction workers and the health risks this poses. So given the increased attention that labor welfare is receiving in recent weeks, and with the spotlight being on big corporations for the way they treat their workers, is there a sense of vindication?
To some extent. So I think the most recent development is that the government said that there would be amendments to the Industrial Relations Act, and they actually came into force on the 1st, which is a really, really good step. So that allows now for sort of stronger collective bargaining and the abolishment of punishment for picketing and strikes, that sort of thing. So this is great. And we can see that sort of positive change, right? And I think that's very much influenced also by outside factors when you look at foreign powers saying, you know, we don't want to trade with you, we don't want to buy these certain things because of these allegations of forced labor. But at the same time, there are other amendments that need to be put forward to enhance and improve worker protection. So that includes amendments to the Trade Union Act, amendments to the Employment Act. Domestic work is still not considered work, so there's that huge lacuna. These things really have to be addressed. And I think we have to keep going. So, you know, it's not time for us to sort of rest on the laurels and say, okay, we've done enough.
Mm-hmm. There's a whole host of other issues that need to be dealt with.
Loads and loads and loads. I mean, there's still poor enforcement when it comes to things like employers keeping the passports of foreign workers. That is a huge problem. Access to remedy, to justice.
Right. There's still a whole host of labor issues that need to be rectified or monitored. Okay, so in the little bit of time that we have, let's talk about a new project that you're launching this year called Project 5050. Can you tell us about this?
So this is something that I came up with in the last couple of months of 2020, because I realized that when I write an analysis or anything, it's increasingly difficult to quote female expert voices. For whatever reason, I think there's a lack of signal boosting. A lot of journalists, we share contacts. So sometimes, you know, the most vocal of these academics get passed around, and that we may overlook real talent who maybe has not been in the limelight. So it's sort of a vicious cycle, right? You get quoted, so your contact gets passed around. But if you've not been quoted, how do you break into that sort of sphere? So I thought that it was time to build a database for policymakers, think tanks, academics, students, even members of the general public who may require it. So came up with a Google form, got a friend of mine, Ash Menon, to help out with the website stuff. I don't know anything about that. Honestly, half the time he tells me what he's doing, I'm like, thumbs up emoji. And yeah, we're hoping to go live this month. We wanted to go live in December, but things got so busy. So we're going to go live this month. And it'll just be a very basic standard website broken up by industry and field. You can search for specific expertise. There'll be a search function. You can, the Google form is still around. So if you're a woman expert, please sign up. We will be updating it every month. And we have about 130 to 150 signups so far, which isn't bad, but isn't great. So I'm hoping by the end of the year, we can increase that to about 1,000, I hope.
And these signups, is it the expert themselves that has to sign up, or can they be nominated, or how does it work?
So it absolutely has to be the expert itself that signs up because of issues of cyber violence, which often is very, very much a gendered thing. So I'm very particular about that. Like I do email and check that it is that person who signed up themselves. I for now, we're not accepting nominations. But of course, you can send the link to someone who you think should be on the website. We're very particular, of course, about consent. If later you want to be removed from the website, you can just write in. And we're also very, very particular about, you know, allegations of harassment or misconduct. So if someone is on the website who perhaps shouldn't be platformed, we do encourage, you know, members of the public to write in and warn us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so far, based on the directory you've compiled, which areas are there a clear lack of women experts?
STEM. Right off the bat, I can tell you STEM. So we have a lot of people from civil society. We have a lot of people from sort of...
I suppose, you know, law as well?
We have a fair number of lawyers so far. It's really, I don't have that many engineers. I think I only have one math person. I have quite a few economists. That's pretty good. Yeah, but sort of natural sciences, pure sciences, I would like more of that. We've got quite a few women in aviation, which I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
That one I was really happy and interested to see. I was like, oh, I'm going to call you.
How do you want to see this resource used?
Well, I personally came up with it because I wanted to help fellow journalists who, you know, like a few female journalists and I, we puckered a long time ago to try and make sure we quote at least one woman expert in every piece we write. So I was thinking journalists, but I've noticed that a lot of academics who have been sharing it amongst themselves have been saying, like, look, this is going to put an end to man. Well, not put an end, but this is going to address the problem of manals. And it seems to be a very pressing issue still for people in academia and think tanks. And you would think 2021, people will be a little bit more switched on, but apparently not. I am really hoping that it becomes a useful index for people who want to see sort of a good mix of voices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's not like a affirmative action sort of thing. No, these are voices that are extant and extremely good, extremely intelligent, but perhaps just haven't been platformed yet.
Mm-hmm. So. Do you think there's a lot of awareness about this? I mean, among your circle of journalists, obviously, yes. But I guess in Malaysian newsrooms in general, is there awareness about this gap in the kind of expertise that they're putting forth, that women's voices aren't being reflected?
I think there's increasing awareness, which I'm really happy to see. Like recently, a friend of mine, Zurairi, he was on a panel for the Women and Girls Forum. And he actually said, look, we've got to stop platforming problematic people and we have to start signal boosting and sort of amplifying women's voices. And I thought, like, that's it in a nutshell, right? And to see someone like that in you know, one of the best newsrooms in Malaysia right now is really heartening. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to increasing diversity coming out of Malaysian journalism.
And let's end on this question then. I mean, it's the first Monday of the year. What are you hopeful for in 2021?
Well, I'm hoping for me or for the country?
Let's do both.
Well, for me, I want to put out really good stories. I'm hoping for 50/50 to become sort of a one-stop shop, as it were, for people looking to embrace gender diversity. I recently started a community organization called Collective Bunga Raya, which is a support group for survivors of sexual harassment and sexual assault. So I'm hoping that that reaches out to people who need it. Yeah, that's for me. For Malaysia, I'm hoping we see some stability in terms of politics. I hope we see better safety nets for the disenfranchised and the oppressed. I hope that the pandemic takes a bit of a backseat, you know, whether through the vaccine or just numbers dropping because of social distancing and best practices, so that we can return to some semblance of normalcy, although I don't think we'll ever reach, you know, the old normal. So, yeah, I think not big wishes, not at all.
Tashni, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I've been speaking to Tashni Sukumaran, Malaysian correspondent with the South China Morning Post. Before we end, here's a quick word from the other half of Project 50/50. Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Ash Menon, and I'm the technical lead for Project 50/50.
Why is this initiative important to you, and when are we going to see it go live?
Why is Project 50/50 important? There is obviously a big disparity in gender representation, not just in my industry, but in industries around the world. And I think that correcting that disparity, correcting that difference is something that's going to benefit all of us. And I think this project goes some way towards that. As to when the site will be live, I think it's safe to look at a timeline of maybe end January, late January to end January.
Thanks very much, Ash. We'll be looking forward to it. You can find them on Twitter at 5050 Malaysia. This has been Pressing Matters on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.